We are gathered together in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God who hath come in flesh. You've each received your text. Of Micah 1, verses 8 through 11. Last week, of course, we were in Micah 1, 1 through 7. And we saw that Micah was predicting judgment upon the then separated northern and southern kingdoms that used to be one kingdom of Israel, now Israel and Judah. We spent most of our time on the concept of the remuneration of a fornicatress and developed and applied it. And now we're in Micah 1, verses 8 through 11. Over this, let me wail and make howling. Let me walk despoiled and naked. I will make a wailing like the dinosaurs and a mourning like daughters of ostriches, because her strokes are grave, because it entered until Judah. It touched until a gate of my people, until Jerusalem. Don't cause it to be disclosed in Gath. You shall not weep. I emphasize weep. In house for dust, wallow in dust. Pass by for yourself, dweller of lovely, with nakedness, shame. The dweller of sheep place didn't exit the wailing of the house beside. He took from you his standing. All right, a number of what you might consider unique translations there. Verse at a time. Over this, verse 8, let me wail and make howling. This is the inspired response of Micah himself, the prophet who will deliver this message. So let me wail and make howling. You should not get the idea from us that we are against or we are squelching emotion. When there is a right, correct emotional response, it's fine for that to be even very pronounced. Like here, I could be sad about this prediction over Samaria and Jerusalem, but if I am allowed to be sad, then I'm allowed to wail and make howling over it. Let me walk despoiled and naked. That is, that he's saying, I don't, just because I'm the deliverer of this message, feel like I am exempt from it. If there was an exemption, let me partake in the sorrow of the nation, of the people of God that I'm a part of. So let me too walk despoiled. You know what it means to walk despoiled? It's to think of spoil. When someone, when one country takes over another and they take the spoil, that is, they strip from them everything that belonged to them. They take their belongings from them, whatever they want. He's saying, let me as well be despoiled or stripped of my belongings, and that to the point of being naked. Oftentimes the rulers of these countries, when they vanquished another, would, to humiliate the people, cause them to walk naked, march naked back to the place they were taking them captive to. So the idea is, I'll share in the plight of the rest of my brethren. I will make a wailing like the dinosaurs, and a mourning like daughters of ostriches. I will make a wailing like the dinosaurs. This is the Hebrew word tanim, and it is, if you look at all of its uses, let's kind of just collect some of the thoughts. I'm not going to go into this in great detail because we did that when we were in Genesis on a Friday night in maybe the second installment of our Genesis studies a long time ago. And therein, I did explain to you why I translated the same word as dinosaurs there. So if you want to access that on our website, download that. If you're still in the CD sympathizer generation, you can get CD from Jason about it. But therein we give the reasons why we go to many of the verses that speak about why we would translate this dinosaurs. Suffice it to say this much today about it. You have a class of animal here. Just like dinosaurs are a class of animal. They're not one species, right? You have the Triceratops and the Brontosaurus, and I know that they've changed the name of that dinosaur some time ago. Won't be politically correct with dinosaurs. They don't care where they're all dead. And so I'll use the old term Brontosaurus. You see that the Apatosaurus or the, you know, the raptors, the small raptors, things like this, they're not one species. They are reptiles that, or at least they assume that they are such. I don't actually put a lot of stock in what these people of pseudoscience say, because they believe other things that are absolutely God-hating. So, one place where we find this word says that even this word draws out to its young. It's talking about presents itself to nurse the children. You don't think of reptiles doing that. So I don't know that just because you find a skeleton that looks reptilian, they have to all be reptilian. But it may be something like the platypus that lays eggs like a reptile, but has mammalian characteristics. It's not fitting the strict classification. Who's to say there wasn't something like that? But these are also found in the sea. But they're found on land. One of them is definitely a serpent, kind of a snake, like a huge extinct snake. We see it in Exodus when we get to this, when we translate in Exodus. When God speaks to Moses, he'll say, "Throw down your rod," and it becomes a snake. And he says, "Now, grab it by the tail," and it becomes a rod again. God gives this to Moses as a sign. Do this in front of Pharaoh, in front of the children of Israel, if they doubt you're really being called of God. Okay, when he actually does it, throws the stick down, and it becomes one of these. And they do the same thing, not the same thing, but they do a like thing, similar looking thing with their occult practices. And this word that we're translating dinosaur swallows up the serpents, the snakes of the magicians. So there is, seems to be a gigantic extinct dinosaurian snake. But some of the other things that talk about these snakes don't fit giant, even extinct snakes. And so it's a class of animal that was contemporary with man. That's one of the things that the scientists of today do not recognize, that these are contemporary with humans. And they're around in the time of the scriptures being written in the Old Testament. And so the KJV will translate this dragons. So if you think my dinosaurs is so strange, KJV was dragons, and they're talking about the same kind of animal. So I will make a wailing like the dinosaurs. You ever see those dinosaur pictures of them anyway? They have this big tube on their head, and they're supposed to have blown through this tube and made some kind of sound through it. Again, I don't know that that's not speculation that they can not be trusted, but this tells us that this categorization of animal made a wailing sound, and those who were alive in the 700s BC knew that sound. They were familiar with that sound because these animals were still around. And a mourning like daughters of ostriches. Ostriches, I am told from someone who heard them firsthand, make this sound as if there is, like there's this crying sound, this terribly sad kind of sound. And why will Micah mourn like this? Because her strokes are grave. That is the stroke. A stroke is when you put a stripe. It's when you strike someone. Strike is the verb. What you get from that, what that is, what you do when you strike is you put a stroke on someone. God is striking, and his strokes are grave. Because it entered until Judah. It touched until the gate of my people, until Jerusalem. Last week he talked some of Samaria. Now it's come into Judah, the southern kingdom, and to the very city of Jerusalem, this prediction. So in verse 10, don't cause it to be disclosed in Gath. Gath is one of the five Philistine cities. So don't go tell this. Don't announce the demise of the people of God amongst those who are not the people of God. How do you think they'll respond to that? Especially these continual enemies of Israel. Look at this same statement in 2 Samuel 1, verses 17 through 20. Gath is one of the Philistine cities. When the Philistines defeated Israel on Mount Gilboa, and Saul and his sons, including Jonathan, were dead, we read this verse. Let's start at verse 17. 2 Samuel 1, beginning at verse 17. Then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. And he told them to teach the children of Judah the bow. That is the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher, which means book of Yashar. It means to be upright, the book of the upright. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. That is another Philistine city. lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Excuse me. So the reason there is given. When you know about some believer and they have fallen in some way, they're defeated. Don't tell someone who is unsaved about it. Don't broadcast it. Don't tell it in Gath. When I first became a pastor, I remember it distinctly, and I think I've mentioned this to some of you in the past, in a teaching in the past. Some of you are too young. I know you are, because it was my first year in the pastorate, and my pastorate's older than you are. So I know that it's older than you are. You can't remember this. Others of you, you might have been around, but you were a little kid, or you weren't a believer, so you weren't real interested in things of believers or whatever. But when I first came here, my preferred method, unlike today, of evangelism was door to door. And I got a map of Indiana from the Chamber of Commerce, and I every time I completed a whole street, I did every house, I went to every house on that street. I'd color in the street, and you know, took the number. I don't know how long it took, but I did the whole of the borough and its streets. Okay, back then I remember doing that as my part of my evangelistic day, and every house I went to, if they were home, they talked with me at all, had to bring up this thing. Because in the news at that time, there were a number of, all at the same time, it was certain high-profile television evangelists. One had fallen into a sin that was, it was found out, it was revealed, and, you know, this was a big-name guy, so everybody knew who he was. And they had him on television. They went to the church that he worked at, the network TV, network, like big networks, went to the church, and they had to be there for the day after this all was exposed to see how he would respond, how he would speak to the congregation that he was a part of, and they got this on tape. And they broadcast this on the news. I mean, every news channel had this on it. Saw this guy crying as he admitted to his sin to this congregation. Well, then another one, they would go around. This is actually very evil, by the way. Not what they did as much as the way that these media moguls responded to it, okay? They went to other big-name pastors / evangelists, teachers, whatever, that were noted, notable, famous on television, and they asked them, what do you think about this guy's fall? And they recorded them, and you know what? One of them who had kind of pronounced judgment on the other, just like a week after that, he was caught in some, heinous, obvious, overt sin. And then they loved it even more. And they ate that up. Because then they showed the clip from the last week where he was condemning this guy. And then they showed what happened this week. And, you know, Christians are all a bunch of judgmental hypocrites. Okay? I remember we lived, it was so early, in the first house that I lived in. I lived in so many houses, but in Indiana. But the first house we lived in, kind of just catacorner to where Danny and Will live right now. And I'm watching this on the news in the living room. My response was very different from the response of one of the guys that they interviewed upon the first fall, you know, who was condemning the other. And there were others, too, that were weighing in on what their brother had done. And I just remember seeing this and just, I was crying terribly over it because I recognized the man and the men to be my brothers, and they're being torn apart in the media. But worse than that was what they were living in and what they had been caught doing. And I remember there was the living room, and the kitchen was just off from it. And my wife was making dinner there. It's, you know, it's the nightly news kind of thing I'm watching. And she's making dinner around that time. And she comes in, she said, "What is the matter?" You know, because I'm wailing like the dinosaurs over it, you know. And mourning like ostriches over it. And then they'd get a whole new battery of people to call them in to speak about the second guy's demise. It was terrible. It was really bad. If you're older and you've been a believer for longer, maybe you know who I'm speaking about. And I'm not going to mention their names because this goes on the internet, and I don't want to publish it in Gath, especially since both of them have seemingly so well rebounded from it. I can talk with you about what we can rejoice over. Talk with you about how well they have bounced back from that. You don't tell someone when, say someone, let's make it Seth, okay? He's sitting right next to me, and I kind of can't use the cat for this. So, let's say Seth doesn't know about this at all. Seth doesn't know who I'm talking about. That's what happens when you give some guy the jitters. He gets all nervous, and because you mentioned his name. Now, let's say he doesn't know about this, and he hears one of these guys on television, and he says, "You know, I heard this guy on TV. He was talking like this." Why would I want to say, "You know what? Number of years ago, he did this." Why would I want to do that? Why let me allow Seth to revel in the good that the man is being used of God to do. Don't publish it in Gath. Don't open up the Christian's dirty laundry out in somewhere in the world. So publish it not in Gath. Please don't talk about it. We should cover it. Love covers a multitude of sins, right? He who hides a matter, conceals it, seeks love. Even when it's believers. And I don't want to tell my fellow believer about what this other believer has done. So don't cause it to be disclosed in Gath. You shall not weep. I emphasize weep. Sometimes people just continue after long rebuke, and it's like we've been sent. God could say, "I've been sending prophets to you. I've been urging you for centuries," would not even be an exaggeration. And now you're going to cry because this comes upon you. You know what? Don't cry. Don't even cry. Because you loved this. I told you about it. I warned you that this was going to happen. Don't cry in front of me now. And act like you're so contrite. In house for dust, wallow in dust. All right, now in your conventional translations, what they're going to do is they're going to transliterate this place name. If you're looking in your New King James Version, which most of you have Beth Ephraim here. Beth Ephraim is their transliteration of what literally is house for dust. Do you see the irony of this? God uses this rhetorical device often. I mean, very often he uses it. In the house of dust, wallow in dust. When you transliterate the name, you don't see the connection. You don't see, and I'm going to submit to you that every one of these names has an assonance or a wordplay to it in the Hebrew, something that you can't get when you don't translate the word into English. Rather, you just transliterate it. And some of them you can't even see when you do translate it because it's the way it sounds. But we'll look at each of them. In house for dust, wallow in dust. When you wallow, it's like you're rolling yourself around on the floor, right? So, dust, putting dust on your head was a sign of penance, contrition, repentance, sorrow for sin. He's saying, you know, don't just put this on your head. Roll around in the dust. Get dusty, get dirt all over. In the place that's called House of Dust. We have names like this. This might sound strange to you, like House of Dust. Beth Ephraim sounds like a place name to me. House for Dust doesn't sound like a place name. That's just because you're not used to it. In English, you don't find any problem with this, right? In English, you have place names, like, and you just are so used to that being a place name. Like, the place, that's a bad one. I don't know, can you think of anything like that? Like, playground? No. Huh? Something that it's like a city. Give me a city name. Like maybe New York. This is the New York of England. Like, this is a New York. There are others. Like, oh, I've got one if I can. I mean, I know it's there, but I can't retrieve it. He said, this is strange. What do you mean? I know, it's there. Okay, yeah, got it. I knew it. Little Rock, Arkansas. Little Rock, okay, is the name of the town. It's the name of the city. Little Rock. If we were translating something from English into some other language, you might want, if we did what our translators are doing here, we would translate Little Rock. You know, and that would mean nothing to them. But what if I was making wordplay on that? Like I said, you know, the rocks of God's judgment will fall on Little Rock. Large rocks will fall on Little Rock. Then there'd be a connection. There'd be a mental, you know, jointure there that everyone would make in their mind if they were hearing it in English. But you wouldn't get it at all if you translated into something like, if we made it into Greek and we called it Oligopetros, you'd understand it. But if there's nothing in Greek that is signified by Little Rock, they're not going to understand that. But if I translate it as Oligopetros, then they'll understand that's a name that means this little rock. And then when I talk about the rock, they'll see what it means. That's what's happening here. And so it's really not helping us to see these place names transliterated. You lose the meaning of it. Okay, verse 11. Pass by for yourself, dweller of lovely. It's the name of a town that your NKJV transliterates Shafir. Shafir means lovely. All right, for all you people, you lovely women that live in the town of lovely. Well, with nakedness, shame. Sometimes very lovely women are very proud of being lovely, and they don't have shame about it, and nakedness was seen as shame. So nakedness, shame. The dweller of Sheep Place didn't exit. You have in your transliteration in KJV Zaanan. That's not even the closest transliteration. Sheep Place is Ta'anan. Okay? Ta'anan. And the dweller of Sheep Place didn't exit. Yatsa is the word for exit here. This time, it's not like the meaning is the same. This time, it sounds kind of the same. And you're saying, it doesn't even sound so much the same to me. When I took Hebrew at one seminary, the teacher there said, I disagreed with it then. I disagree with it now. But he said, this is a language that depends on spoken sounds. It doesn't depend on... It's not a language for writing. It's a language for speaking. And I thought, there are so many things like this that I would never pick up on if I just heard it. I say the opposite. I say, this is a language designed for writing. Because I can see this connection on the page better than I can hear it. And that kind of stuff happens all the time in Hebrew. So there is a connection between Sheep Place and exit by way of written assonance, if I'm allowed to speak like that. Then, the wailing of the house beside. You have Beth Ezel in anglicized transliteration into the NKJV. This place, literally meaning the house beside, he took from you his standing. That is, this sounds like the New Testament where the Lord Jesus Christ talks about if you don't change your mind, I'll remove your lampstand. Like, there's a lampstand standing there. It's standing. It's a lampstand. I'm going to take it away. This is what God has done to the city. The house beside, he took from you his standing. The idea, think of this, the house, the name of this place gets its name from where it's positioned, where it stands. It's beside. Well, beside what? Beside a number of things. It's kind of sandwiched between the people of God and those who are outside the pale of the people of God. That is, outside the border. This is to the east. This place was, at least, to the east of Jerusalem. It was beside Jerusalem. And it was near the Jordan. It was beside the other side of it, where the people of God were not. The house beside. He's going to... Your whole name comes from where you're located. Comes from your location. I'm going to remove your location. I'm going to wipe you out and take you away. You're not going to exist anymore. Let's apply this information in a way that it is very relevant to the New Testament believer. And that is why it was written, as the scriptures say. We talked about it last week, that concept. But you're looking at God's discipline / punishment. Now, you may recall when I said things in the number of months that we were focusing on Wednesday nights on the word chesed, that discipline isn't punitive, and that discipline isn't for punishment, it's for correction. And when we receive chastening from God, it's not punishment, it's discipline, it's training for us. So now why am I kind of folding those two into each other? Because only God can do this. I mean, this takes supernatural activity. There are people in these cities who are not Yahwists. They are not believers. We saw last week with our talk about idolatry and its remuneration spoken of as that of a fornicatress, that a lot of these people aren't even Yahwists. They don't believe in one God, let alone that his name is Yahweh. For them, it is punishment. But they are under a covenant with God that has them covenantally the people of God. And there are those who may not be guilty of idolatry, but are guilty of other things, wherein that they've rejected the word of God. They'll receive this as discipline. And is it possible, I'm saying by talking like this, that it is, that it's more than possible that this happens, that certain events that affect whole groups of places, they may be punishment for the lost, but they are definitely not punishment for those who are the saved. But it may be discipline. You can begin to kind of run this out in your mind and say, like, what kind of situations would that be? Well, like, what about this somewhat recent one? I'm sure that there were people on the eastern seaboard when this Superstorm Sandy, as they're calling it, wiped out all these out, that were believers. And God doesn't allow it to happen to them unless there is some divine purpose for it. How does he do that? I don't know. It's too high for me how he does that, how he works that. For, like, he brings it on. You say, really, God didn't do it? Yeah, God did it. God did it. Amos. We'll speak like this. He said, if there is a calamity in a city, did not I, Yahweh, do it? That means you can say that, yes, while there are maybe evil people involved in the execution of that will of God, God ultimately, because he's sovereign, can be credited, not faulted, but credited with doing that. I recently said to someone that this gate that has become so famous in our country, 9/11, God did that. They got very upset with that because they said that evil people did that. And they said Muslim radicals did that. God's not for that. God is bigger than we are. God uses people. They're saying he allowed it. I'm saying he allowed it. But I'm saying more than that. I'm saying God did it. Amos doesn't flinch at language like that. Amos doesn't diminish God's sovereignty by saying, if we can find something that's evil in there, if we can find something that's not good against us, then God didn't do that. God would never do that. God did that. Amos talks about it. We're going to talk about it that way too. But in his doing it, and this is the part that's baffling to finite minds like ours, it's designed for one thing, for the lost. It's designed for something else. And I'm not even saying it's always designed for punishment upon the lost. I'm saying I'm saying that God's got his reasons, he's got his purposes. I'm not judging anybody with that. I'm just saying God's got his purposes that are holding true for those who are not believers. But he's doing something altogether different with those who are his believers. Here he is the one bringing this to pass upon people in covenant with him. The covenant nation under law. Well, this one's obvious because they're so bad. 9/11 couldn't have been punishment because what? The United States is so good. You can't say that. Yeah, but not as bad as this. Really not as bad as this? I'm not saying it's punishment. I'm just telling you that I'm going all the way with God's sovereignty here. And I'm agreeing with Amos in what he says. Micah speaks, and we, with the advantage of hindsight, can look back on it and say, Micah speaks about the Assyrians invading the northern kingdom and deporting them, enslaving them, taking them captive. And when he talks about Judah, he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylon, enslaving, deporting these southern Israelites. Does God still do that? Hebrews 12. New Covenant would say that he does still do that. First Peter will talk about it. It is time for judgment to begin at the house of God. So that's the church, right? We see an aspect of God here in Micah that we don't see so much in the New Testament, or that we don't focus on that often. One of the reasons we don't focus on it that often is because it's in Micah. Do you realize that in studying Micah, if you just come on Friday nights and study Micah, I've said this about other things, but you'll know things that the vast, huge majority of Christians know nothing about. Because whoever studies Micah, have you ever been to a church or seen it on TV or anything? You ever known of a Bible study on Micah that goes that's taken place in other churches? Maybe you have. That'd be good. But as we develop the picture of some of the aspects of our God to give us a sharper perception of what he's really like in Micah, let us not kind of relegate it to that's how God was then. Jesus Christ is our God. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The one having ears to be hearing, let him be hearing.